Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Okay, so maybe not quite yet the time to crack open the Perrier Jouet, if I may say.
Oh, really good pronunciation of that.
I had to Google it.
Okay. Why not? Mike McKee's here. We can do that.
We could do it.
It's
we could
Thursday.
Do it.
It's a leap day.
Yeah. Let's talk about, though, the report. Underlying.
Oh, I'd rather talk about champagne.
Well, we'll talk about maybe the price of champagne. Let's just bring Mike in, because let's get to the report and what we got. It is the report, Mike, we have been talking about for a while here. We know this is the one that the Fed watches. Tell us what we got and why there was a bit of sigh of relief here.
Well, the sigh of relief was it wasn't worse. The numbers came in on a month-over-month basis higher than they had in previous months. The core rate was up on a month-over-month basis, 0.4, which was the highest in a year, and it sounds terrible. But because of base effects and the progress they've made on disinflation on the year-over-year basis, we continued to see the PCE and the core go down. And that's what people want to see, because that's what the Fed wants to see. We're still a ways from 2% if you're using core as sort of your measuring stick at 2.8%, but there was progress. And the economy's not doing badly. Personal income went up 1%. And wages still went up 0.4%, which is healthy. Spending was a little weak, but remember there was a lot of storms in January. People didn't go out. We know they didn't buy cars and things like that. So overall, this is the Goldilocks soft landing story continues.
So break open the champagne, in other words.
I knew you'd get around to that.
It's only 2 o'clock.
Yes or no? Yes or no?
Yes, go right ahead.
So Mike, remind us why this is the Fed's preferred measure of inflation. Why do we care so much about PCE and over CPI, for example?
Well, basically, the PCE is a bit broader, but it also is a little bit more reflective of what people are spending on. It includes a lot of imputed data, which is data that they try to figure out by measuring parts of the economy rather than just prices, because they don't have prices on things like financial. Like portfolio management was one of the biggest movers, up 5% in the month, because the markets are doing so well.
Right.
So they're looking at the markets and they're looking at the gain in the markets and they're guessing sort of what the commissions would be, et cetera, and the fees, and they impute a number from that. But that's not counted in the CPI. And for example, the CPI will measure what you pay for your monthly car insurance, whereas the PCE will measure what you pay, and it also measures what value you get. In other words, how much will your policy pay if you're in an accident? And of course, that has to keep likely going up because cars keep getting more expensive. So that's the kind of thing that's the difference between them. And so the Fed just prefers it. They normally don't run very far apart, but they have been running far apart over the last year.
Well, as an economist, I mean, what do you trust as really kind of telling the true picture of inflation? Because I do feel like there's a bit of a debate when it comes to some of the economic statistics that are out there about whether they not, you know, accurately reflect what's going on in the U.S. economy. How do you see it? Because I feel like, Mike, you're so good at kind of of pulling in, yes, government statistics, real world statistics. I don't know. How do you see it?
They actually had this debate on the podcast with Tracy Alloway and Joe Weisenthal today. And the experts they were talking to basically came down, I think, about where I would come down, that there are so many different measures. And even though there's a wedge between the PCE and CPI, it's about 100 basis points now. It's normally somewhere between 35 and 50. Mm. So it's not very wide. And really, we can't say, given all the different measures, exactly what inflation is.
Right.
So the CPI has the most categories. It's the most up to date. The PPI and the CPI feed into PCE. So PCE depends on CPI. So I guess I would go with the CPI. That doesn't mean I think that the 3.9% is where we should be. There's a lot of talk of the Fed maybe changing its inflation mm-hmm. target to maybe 3% or something like that. But overall, maybe the CPI,
That's just talk. The Fed has denied that they're going to do that many, many times over the last year.
Well, they're denying it now, because if you do it now, when you have
you're
moving the goalposts.
Right.
They do now have a procedure so that every 5 years they look at their monetary policy framework, and that's coming up in 2025.
So do you think that, given what we've seen over the last 18 months with the data, Mike, that they would consider actually changing it when there is a time to do that?
I think they would. 2% was never a number written in stone. It was what the New Zealand Central Bank adopted a number of years ago, and it sort of became a de facto standard. And the idea was basically, what's not too high and not too low? Because if you're too
low,
you have no way to lower rates if you're at zero. And if you're too high, then people get mad because you have inflation. So they pick 2%. They could easily pick 3%. And people have been urging that on them for years. So it's something I'm sure they'll talk about.
All right. So the data this week, we all were kind of leading up, I feel like, in a big way to this Thursday report of PCE core and the read on inflation that the Fed follows. The narrative, if you put it all together, including some of the other data points that we got today, is there one clear narrative or a bit of a mixed narrative?
It's a mostly clear narrative that the economy is doing well. Interesting number we haven't mentioned and didn't get a lot of attention today because of the PCE was pending home sales really mm-hmm. tanked in the last month. And that's maybe a sign that we're seeing the higher mortgage rates bite, which is, despite Elizabeth Warren's desires, that's what the Fed wants to see.
Right.
So we seem to be doing and getting what the Fed is looking for. Next week, we'll see jobs. And if the jobs numbers hold in, it'll tell you that the other side of their mandate is doing well. And that's the feeling that they will hold in. So at this point, we get volatility.
Jay Powell
but no
was
real
right
change.
Saying, hey, the economy's good.
Jay Powell was reasonably right. I don't know if you saw the Wall Street Journal story today about whether Chris Waller or Larry Summers was right. And Nick Timmermans from the Wall Street Journal comes down on Chris Waller's side that we didn't have to have 6% unemployment.
So it's interesting to hear that. We did speak to someone yesterday who said that we've already had a soft landing. Chris Ailman over at CalPERS.
Yeah.
CalSTRS, excuse me. Are we going to start seeing more of that, Mike? Are people going to finally say, okay, we can declare that this landing has happened and has indeed been a soft one?
Yeah, it's kind of at what point do you consider the economy landed? There have been people who say we've been on the runway for a while, and others say, well, you know, it's never quite there. So it'll be a couple of months, probably when the Fed starts cutting rates. If we get to that point, that would suggest that we're still making a lot of progress towards sustainable low inflation, and you could call that a soft landing. Other people will look back in history and say, well, this has been a soft landing. The mm-hmm. Fed's done a pretty good
Feels
job.
Feels like it.
They'll never say it.
Goldilocks says it's okay.
You know, it's like jinxing yourself, but they will feel it.
All right, we're going to say thanks to Michael McKee, Bloomberg News International Economics and Policy Correspondent.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Got to talk a little bit about WW International shares dropping following earnings last night and news that Oprah Winfrey said she's preparing to leave its board. We've been talking about it all day here at Bloomberg. Stock down nearly 27% at its lows today, lowest point since they began trading back in 2001. And you might recall that back in 2015, that's when Oprah signed on, bought a 10% stake in the company. That news and move revived the stock for a while and the narrative, Tim, around the company.
Well, that narrative changing again today and news of Oprah's departure, delivering the latest blow to the obesity-focused company that's struggling to stay relevant in the Ozempic era. We got a great roundtable joining us to discuss the news and the environment that WW exists in. Bloomberg News reporter Jerry Smith is with us right now, and Bloomberg News health reporter Madison Mueller, both here in the studio. Good to have you both with us. Hey, Jerry, I want to start with you because we did see the stock, WW stock, drop last night following quarterly results and the news that Oprah was leaving the board. What's bigger here? Is it the results or is it Oprah no longer being on the board here?
I mean, I think Oprah is, you know, deciding that she's not going to run for re-election on the board is a big deal. I can't think of many celebrity brand relationships that are more iconic than her relationship with Weight Watchers. So for her to no longer be on the board, I think investors saw that as, you know, a potential concern.
To be fair, and we're going to bring up the chart again for everybody. We just showed it. I mean, the chart of WW shares, what they have done since Oprah came on board, and you could see that uptick that was shortly after she came on board, hitting a high, and then it's just been kind of a tougher slog, if you will, since then. Madison, come on in on here. You know, we've talked with you too about WW. I mean, you know, they've got a new strategy moving forward.
Right, right. And I think that this is sort of in a time when they are trying to make their brand appear to be relevant still and really get people, you know, signed on to the idea that Weight Watchers is still needed, that it's relevant. Like, Oprah leaving at this time is just not a good, it's not good for the image when they're already struggling with their image. It's sort
but
of a double whammy.
You know what's kind of crazy is she's doing exactly, right, Jerry, with what the company's trying to do. They're saying, we're going to embrace these new weight loss drugs. That's what she has done too.
Yeah, I mean, I think the company itself, it's been fascinating how, you know, it's a fundamental shift in how we think about weight loss. And this was a company that really emphasized for years, you can lose weight if you just eat right and you have
count
enough
points.
Willpower. Yeah. And now, I mean, the arrival of Ozempic and all these weight loss drugs has really forced this company to recalculate.
But it doesn't, it just makes me, like, I'm trying to understand that this is what Oprah's doing. So you would think it would almost make more sense for her to stay because she's used these drugs, gets what the company's doing in kind of this latest brand shift.
Perhaps that's why investors are concerned. If she's not sticking with it, maybe there's a difference in strategy or something that, you know, remains to be seen at this point. Not saying that's happening, but,
no,
you know, and that could be what one of the reasons why the stock is reacting that way. So, Madison, talk a little bit about the shift that we're seeing at WW right now, because as Carol mentioned, this is a company known for counting points, I mm-hmm. should say, the meetings, the in-person
right.
stuff, the line of food. How have the GLP-1s disrupted that?
Yeah, so, I mean, Weight Watchers acquired Sequence, which is a telehealth provider, last year. And so what they're trying to do is bring this older, you know, the historic Weight Watchers brand to GLP-1 prescribing and sort of combine them and say, you know, you're still going to have this community, you're still going to get support, behavioral support, you know, medication management, things like that, and have that sort of along with the drug and, you know, have a provider who can help you manage the medications and everything. And so that's sort of been their rebrand. And I guess, I mean, it sort of shows, like, Oprah is she said that she's taking one of these drugs now.
Right.
And so she, I mean, her departure from Weight Watchers sort of, like, proves again that she herself maybe doesn't need those services. I don't know if she said, like, whether or not she's actually using their product, but a lot of the patients that I've spoken to that are taking GLP-1 drugs are like, we don't feel like we would need something like this. We have that community sort of on social media. Mm. We have doctors that can help us manage the side effects or help us manage, you know, the medications in general. So we don't really see the need for something like what Weight Watchers is offering, which is this sort of behavioral support program in tandem with prescribing GLP-1 drugs.
I mean, it's a great question, Jerry. You do wonder, like, what does WW become going forward when the community aspect of this and the platform to support you in your, you know, goal of losing weight, if that goes away, are they just a distributor of drugs, basically, right? Of these weight loss drugs? Like, what do they become?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the big question is, how does this company stay relevant right now? You know, I mean, there's analysts who think this market for obesity drugs is going to be huge. But, you know, they're not for everybody. And, you know, there's people, you take these drugs, but you have to keep taking them over and over. And maybe there's a role for Weight Watchers in the future and just supporting these people who, you know, maybe they don't want to take it for their entire life. But yeah, I mean, that's something this company is really struggling to figure out.
To Jerry's point, Madison, do you think that it's fair to say some critics could argue that investors are kind of putting the cart before the horse here because we don't know? Carol, when I say we don't know, you always point out that these drugs have been around for other uses for quite a bit of time.
So, diabetics have been using.
Right, to be fair. But we don't necessarily know when they're used purely for weight loss.
Yeah.
Not long-term effects, but sort of long-term trends. What needs to be done, other support systems that people need.
Right. I mean, that's very true. It's a good point that Jerry brought up because there's a lot of issues with like long-term durability with these drugs right now. One, because they're very expensive. Not all insurance companies cover them, so some people can't afford them and then they're forced to go off of the drugs. There's still really widespread supply shortages, which a lot of the doctors I've spoken to have said that that continues to be an issue. It's not something that has really gotten any better, and so they're having to take patients off of the drugs, and then, you know, these are drugs that are meant to be taken forever, so what happens after that? So like, there could still be a place for Weight Watchers,
right?
Maybe there, maybe that's their sweet spot. But there are so many telehealth companies that are cropping up now to, one, prescribe weight loss drugs, to help with you know, what happens after you go off of weight loss drugs, offering different types of nutrition therapy, things like that. Like, this industry has just gotten more competitive, so they're just going to have more people to face off with.
Well, and Jerry, maybe that played out in terms of the 2024 revenue forecast, right? Because that was a disappointment from WW.
Yeah, their 2024 forecast for sales came in lower than what Wall Street was expecting. So I think it was probably a combination of Oprah's decision to leave the board and the lighter revenue forecast that investors were concerned about. I just think, big picture, it's very hard to be in this business on Wall Street where we're seeing these companies. Just the other day, a biotech company said that you know, they had good data on an obesity drug and their stock doubled.
I believe that's Viking Therapeutics, right?
So it's just like, we're seeing these enormous swings in share prices based on, you know, are you going to be relevant in the weight loss drug era? Are you not going to be relevant? So I think it's tough for Weight Watchers when, you know, an announcement where Oprah puts out a press release saying she's not going to join, you know, be on the board, and then the stock just gets, you know, hammered.
Madison, go to Viking though, because, and I'm glad you brought that up, because it does feel like every week or something we're looking at a different company.
Right.
What do we know about that company and kind of their potential role in all of this?
Yeah, I mean, we were looking at that company the other day. I think there's something like 37 employees. It's really small. And this is phase two data that we're talking about. So it still has a long way before it actually gets to
patients. For their own obesity drug.
Yes, yes.
But Madison, does it raise the question that the moat that a company like Eli Lilly and that Novo Nordisk would have is not as deep of a moat, given that there is progress being made by these other companies?
Yeah, I mean, there's progress being made by these other companies, and those are sort of making them a possible acquisition target for drug makers that don't have, you know, a presence in weight loss yet. Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk, I mean, from the conversations I've had with them, like, their pipelines run very deep and they are looking at every single thing. Like, they have really early stage, you know, discovery programs, and they're looking at every single thing that these other company, or they say they are, that these other smaller biotech companies are looking at. But companies like Merck, like Bristol-Myers, Pfizer, who sort of need to get into this giant market still, they could, you know, buy one of these smaller companies.
Viking, by the way, now an $8.6 billion market company, but on Tuesday it was up like 121% on this news. One last thought, Jerry. Oprah still is going to kind of be involved, though, with the company. She's going to help them, I guess, with a conference and stuff, so she's kind of still around.
Yeah, she said that she's still going to, you know, continue to collaborate with Weight Watchers, you know, and address issues like the stigma of obesity. I mean, as we were talking, I was just thinking, like, how interesting it would be if Oprah, you know, got involved with like Eli Lilly or Novo. I would think those two companies are probably reaching out to her people. I mean, it's, you know, that would be a very interesting development.
And you know what they have? Lots of money these days.
That's
so
true.
It's a good point.
That's actually a really interesting point. Great stuff. And this is certainly something that's very topical, again, for a second year in terms of these weight loss drugs. Guys, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Jerry Smith, reporter at Bloomberg News, here in studio with us, along with Madison Mueller, who's health reporter at Bloomberg News. But shares of WW really tanking, Tim, in today's session.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Okay, Carol, we've talked about this before. Just how much value did Taylor Swift bring to the NFL and to the Chiefs? Well, according to the brand analytics firm Apex Marketing Group, the tie-up between Travis Kelce and Swift is worth $331.5 million to the NFL and to the Chiefs. These figures courtesy of the Wall Street Journal earlier this month.
That's some real money. All right. The reason, fandom, the people like my sister.
Like
your sister, right? Like my daughter. Well, maybe I don't know if she started watching, but we certainly talked about it a lot. This year, they started watching every Kansas City Chiefs game and even got a Swift jersey. Your sister?
Yeah.
Someone who actually did
right? It was really annoying. She's like, we were all together once. And she's like, I have to watch the game. I'm like, since when do you watch the game?
Like, did you guys see that play? No, did you guys see Taylor? Like, cheering?
I care about this.
All right. Well, the concept of fandom is what got our next guest to look into how it feeds into consumer sentiment. We got with us Katie Thomas, back with us, lead at the Kearney Consumer Institute, joining us on Zoom from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Katie, great to have you back with us. I do feel like, man, Taylor makes us the effect that she has had on our world in so many different ways. Talk to us about fandom and what you guys looked into specifically.
Well, exactly. I mean, thanks. It's great to be back with you guys. That's exactly what motivated us, was all this, you know, it was sort of two fandoms clashing together, right? Taylor Swift and the NFL. But we also have a podcast called Inside the Mind, where we were talking to super fans. We had fans of sports teams that were, you know, Manchester United, that were just so committed, and they invest a lot of time and money into their fandom. And we realized as we dug into it further, though, it's particularly topical in the U.S. right now and all around the world, because we're so polarized that fandom used to be generally a good thing, or something maybe you'd have a bit of fun with. You'd have a rival or a product that you hated on in a fun way. But it's really, now that we're so polarized, it can actually be a challenge of finding that sweet spot of, you know, really being an enthusiast of a brand, but not tipping over that edge into, if you're not with me, you're against me. And that's what really motivated us to dig into fandom and understand a little bit more how it relates to some of the big challenges we're seeing today, such as brand risk, brand loyalty, and even how to build and cultivate community.
Yeah, so talk about that a little bit, because there's certainly this double-edged sword, as you mentioned in your research, about when it comes to fandom. And I think, for example, I don't know if this is relevant to this conversation, but it makes me think of, Carol, what we saw with Wendy's earlier this week, when, you know, they said there was going to be surge pricing and their earnings call, and everybody freaked out about the price of the Baconator changing on these digital meal these digital menus at drive-thrus and at restaurants. So how did this type of sort of, you know, fandom come into the research?
Yeah, so I mean, I think you're spot on, Tim, which is that's exactly what we've seen. Hating on a brand used to be lighthearted. It used to be Miracle Whip, right? Which was a polarizing product that some people loved it, some people hated it. Then a few years ago, we saw it start to get a little bit more political with, you know, perhaps Nike and other brands that, you know, seemed like they were taking a stance. But we've just become further entrenched in some of this polarization as well as access to information. So you're seeing people just so quickly get spun up into a story. And so what we really said was, first, you want to start by just understanding who your consumers are and just how much of a fan they are. Are they buying your product because it's habit or because they're truly loyal, they're truly a fan or an enthusiast of the brand? And then if they are a super fan, how much risk does that open you up to? So we think about, you know, like certain football teams, for instance, I think are a great example. You see people with trade decisions or draft decisions. You see people get really opinionated to the point where they get angry and they feel personally betrayed by it. So it's really thinking about how to balance that emotional connection to the brand and still drive engagement.
Yeah. You know, what's kind of rough is I just think about, you know, especially coming off the pandemic and George Floyd, we talked about the importance of companies to step up and take positions on, you know, things that are going on in society, helping to kind of, you know, lay out what's right, what's wrong, and take a position, support their employee base as a result. But I feel like companies and also the influencers or stars that they align with, like, can work out great, or it also can get them into trouble. So it's not easy.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely, Carol. We've seen just what you're describing, which is for a long time, we all fell into that sort of narrative around people are seeking transparency for brands. People want brands to stand up and say something. And you're seeing that walk back a little bit because we're realizing that's exactly what happened, which is it made just simple things you buy and made it political. And so the conversations we're having are really around, are the stances that we're taking true to the brand or true to certain people that work on the brand? And that's where it starts to get a little bit trickier of making sure it's like stances you take on specific social issues feel like they're part of the ethos of a brand. And most importantly, perhaps that you're willing to lose sales. And so we've seen, you know, Patagonia is a good example.
I knew you were going to say
a
that.
Brand. Yeah. But willing to take a stand. Oh, go ahead, Tim.
But well, it's a private company.
Yeah.
And, yes. You know, it's fair, I think, to say that a lot of the people who buy Patagonia would be aligned with the company's values. So I feel like that's not really a risky one. But it's kind
exactly.
of, it's kind of an outlier today. I mean, are there any other brands
you can
point
to? Part of their ethos, right? Like in terms.
Oh, for sure. I mean, are there any other brands you can point to?
Oh, I think that's actually the exact argument to be made here, which is when you really are a bigger mainstream brand, there should be a lot of thoughtfulness around exactly what it means to take a stand and what good looks like, and really checking in with, you know, is there any risk here in terms of alienating the core? How do we stay on message? What's the simple brand message that we're trying to stay true to here? And if we do have any backlash, how do we stay true to that message as opposed to getting lost in the nuance of it all? But sometimes less is more. And we're realizing that even though for a while consumers were voicing, oh, I want a brand to stand up for a specific cause, that maybe that's not actually the case. And there's more risk there than good.
Katie, is it safe to say, though, when it comes down to it, companies, they're going to be very careful, cautious in terms of who they align with? I mean, I think of Bud Light, right? The controversy over there. I mean, because they don't want to impact, especially if they're publicly held, they don't want to impact the top line. They don't want to impact sales growth. So if they are nervous, they're going to back away.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, coming all the way back around to fandom, it's really thinking about who your lovers are. How do you take the people that are in a bit of a lower part of the funnel? So maybe they're buying your product on habit, or maybe they're a fan, but they're not necessarily outspoken and advocating for your brand. How do you move them up the funnel a little bit, become more of a lifestyle brand? So some of those brands you've seen recently are anything from, you know, Carhartt's a good example, Lululemon. You've seen those brands start to extend a little bit and feel like they're more ingrained in people's lifestyles. So really focusing on that upside, and then mitigating the risks on the other side is how you can kind of like almost leverage that fandom to operate through this hazy environment.
Yeah, when it works really well, or it can for a company. When it goes south, not so great. Katie Thomas, thanks so much. Have a great weekend. She's the lead at the Kearney Consumer Institute.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow. Did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann. Let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
You drive, stay in crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just about 18 minutes left in today's trading session. Our next guest says investors are living through a bull market and that the bull market is just hitting its stride.
Let's drive to the close with Lauren Sanfilippo, Senior Investment Strategist for Merrill and Bank of America Private Bank. Lauren, good to have you with us right now. You argue that investors are living through a bull market, but it's hindered by negativity bias. What does that mean?
Yeah, I think this setup this year is certainly hindered by an election year, right? There's a lot of volatility and associated volatility and uncertainty. But there's a lot of things to look forward to, right? We have this Fed pivot that's being priced in. Growth is certainly surprising to the upside. The Fed Atlanta tracker for GDP for this quarter, 3.2%. So again, surprises to the upside will certainly matter and I think carry the market through this year.
All right. So kind of interesting. It's funny to hear what you're saying. And I feel like it builds on the guest that we had yesterday, Louis Navalier, right? Who was saying that markets are kind of getting ready to, or they're partying like it's 1999, but he wasn't saying that they're the same kind of market. Lauren, having said that, in terms of your broad macro view, what parts of the market do you find interesting?
Yeah, so I think what we're seeing now is still this narrow trade at the top, right? But I think there are other sectors that are doing less bad as compared to last year. So look no further than financials. They're up 7% so far this year. Healthcare up another 6%. So we are expecting this broadening to sort of take place. And I think that certainly will include energy even, right? We can think about getting cyclical for the first time in a while. So that's exciting us, and we're actually making allocations towards those areas.
Can I just ask you though, the energy, and I'm looking at it, it's kind of near the bottom of the pack when you look at the major industry groups in the S&P 500. Out of 11, it's in ninth place, still up about 2.2%. How much of your interest is the consolidation that we're seeing a little bit?
Well, right. So I think that definitely is a factor in it, but I mean, we're nowhere near peak oil demand. There's such good fundamentals, I think, in the energy patch. And, you know, that green transition, it's definitely been tricky. And energy's balance sheets just generally look good. So we think that's an attractive sector. We're looking to put money to work.
What concerns you right now? What worries you and the team?
You know, what concerns me is that we're fairly convinced of this Fed pivot, right? And I think the runway now, 2 months into the year, I think the runway for the March watch list items, we definitely have to get confirmation that PMIs have bottomed. So that sort of needs to come through. I think next week's job report, we're going to be looking at pretty carefully, right, for that other side of the mandate. And I just think every print really on the runway to June, which we anticipate being the first rate cut, we'll be watching very carefully.
You know, it's kind of interesting too, and I'm, like I'm saying, kind of layering on some of the market conversations that we've had around this table, Lauren, but this idea of profits going forward, maybe expectations are too low for the next couple of quarters, so that provides some good impetus, if you will, to send shares, equity shares, higher. Election years, because you tend to have candidates who promise you everything, tend to ultimately be pretty good. And I think that there was one more was it the kind of Fed being maybe done? You kind of put it all together, and that basket really provides maybe a very good environment, certainly for more equity momentum, which you argue for.
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting. Election year, I actually think, is an opportunity to be smarter than the rest. And I talk to clients all the time who feel skittish in this environment, right? But I think the underlying idea here is just to stay invested. And actually, that is smarter than the rest. So I think, you know, that's really the main tenet for this year.
So it's so interesting to hear this from you, because this is the, I mean, this is the conversation that it really seems like the conversation has pivoted. And it feels like, at least to me, Carol, that more and more of our guests lately have been optimistic than pessimistic. And something has really shifted in, I don't know, in recent weeks.
Well, and I think some of it, Lauren, how much, you know, Tim brings up a good point, and we talk about it all the time. Here we got, you know, the Fed's preferred inflation gauge, right, and what it tells us. And, you know, it's still, you know, not exactly where the Fed wants it to be, but we're way down from where we were a year ago, and it didn't come in hotter than forecast. Having said that, you know, this clarity that maybe we're getting when it comes to Fed policy, right, that the Fed, you know, despite some outliers saying we could actually get higher, some more rate increases, for the most part, the market is just saying it's not if we're going to get rate cuts, it's just a matter of when. And that does provide some clarity about the outlook.
Yep, it's a question of not if, but when. Totally agree with you on that. And you know, core this morning, headline running at 2.4, headline running at 2.4, core running at 2.8. What's interesting about that is that actually that's where the Fed thought that those measures would be running by year end, right? So come March, we're going to have to see their update, their new rendition of the summary of economic projections, their dot plot. So I think a recalibration, you're right, does need to happen. There's a lot of bullishness out there. It's actually a little bit tougher to find a bear, right?
It is. And that has me wondering if there's a contrarian signal there.
Yeah, you know, I think perhaps we don't think so. We're in this bullish camp. I mean, I understand the hesitation when everyone's sort of on one side of the boat, right? You wonder, right? I totally understand that hesitation. And I can remember last year when strategists, economists were all forecasting for a recession, right? And that never happened. So I'm with you. I'm with you. But I do think that earnings, basically what you were talking about, Carol, 11% earnings growth for this year. I mean, that's just going to, that's going to drag the market higher, right? It might be a bit lofty. We at Bank of America think we're looking at maybe 5 or 6% growth for this year. But again, that's still pretty good growth after that earnings reset that we got last year.
Well, and the other thing is, Lauren, nothing's ever in a vacuum, right? So you're looking at the U.S. as a developed market compared to other developed markets around the world that are not, it's not going as well as it is in the United States. So investors who can choose anywhere. Having said that, do you see any kind of overvaluation when you look at the U.S. market, anything getting a little bit too hot that makes you a little bit nervous? I think about the Magnificent Seven. I think about, you know, the AI names, the big tech cap names. Anything that you say, it's okay to maybe take some money off the table. I hate to use that expression, but any areas that you think are a little hot and that a little bit of a correction will make them more attractive in your view?
Well, that's an interesting point, right? Because international is breaking out now to some all-time highs we've seen on their indices for some time. And we're definitely getting questions from clients now on when international will come back. I think all along, though, there's been some quality companies to look at, like even in Europe as the example here, right? I mean, you're seeing actually a very concentrated trade happening there. It's sort of like the Magnificent Seven in Europe. So that's certainly playing out. And, you know, Europe can be in recession and their multinationals are leveraged to the U.S., right, and the U.S. consumer. So it, as a benefit, really, those names can work. So I think we're seeing a little bit of that now, and maybe global growth is even bottoming.
All right, going to leave it on that note. Hey, Lauren, thanks so much. Thanks for dropping by and sharing your view with us. Lauren Sanfilippo, she's Senior Investment Strategist over at Merrill and Bank of America Private Bank, joining us in New York City.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.